Welcome to Beyond the Shelf. I'm Scott Curry with Chef's Best. We gather to talk about the trends in marketing, retail, and production in food and beverage that are shaping the industry. Joining us today is Andre Darlington, food and beverage author and journalist. Andre is author of the newly released book, Booze Cruise, a tour of the world's essential mixed drinks. He has written or co-written some awesome eclectic takes on cocktails, including Gotham City Cocktails, official handcrafted foods and drinks from the world of Batman. He is also co-author of Booze and Vinyl, a spirited guide to great music and mixed drinks, The New Cocktail Hour, the essential guide to handcrafted drinks, and Movie Night Menus, dinner and drink recipes inspired by the films we love. Andre has been a columnist for Organic Life magazine, a co-editor of the health-conscious cocktail website, Sprig and Spirit, and a contributor to Mandarin Quarterly, as well as the alt-weekly Isthmus, where he has an award-winning food critic and wine columnist. In 2016, he opened the lauded farm-to-table restaurant Natural Wine Bar Field Table. In addition to food and beverage writing, Andre has published two books of poetry as well. You can find all of his work at andredarlington.com, and in particular, his new Booze Cruise book you can find there and at Amazon as well. Andre, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on.
All right. So look, when you were growing up, did you imagine being a world-traveling cocktail connoisseur and have a chance to write about it? You lead what quite, I would say, is quite an envious life. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm sure you have the many troubles we do, but you've managed to piece together, I think, a lot of your passions and your talent in writing into quite a life. So what's it like being a world-traveling cocktail connoisseur, if I may call you that?
You know, the career has come on fast and furious, so I don't get a lot of opportunity to sit back and think just how bizarre it is. But also, it is in the back of my mind every morning when I sit down to on my laptop to start writing for the day. I do ask myself, like, how did I get here? It is a strange one. Yeah.
How did I get there?
I started out as a food and beverage writer. And actually, I was writing mostly about wine. If I had a beverage that I wrote about most, I had a wine column. I did have a cocktail column, sort of in the mid to late 2000s when cocktails were sort of first rolling across the United States. But then it just as one book has led to the other until this most recent book, where I circumnavigated the globe in late 2019, just before COVID. So this newest book is sort of the culmination. You know, I've been writing about food and beverage for about 20 years. So I'm, you know, deep in these books, but I certainly couldn't have written them any sooner.
And you passed on the name, COVID Cocktails, because you can't go
yeah,
there.
Exactly.
I bring the cocktails to you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we couldn't have made up the timing. The book, you know, all the books start in, that slightly different shape or form. I feel like books are almost like writing a movie a lot of times, where you hand in a script and the press does different things with it. This book kind of started out as a, maybe we should look at some of the interesting cocktail foods that have gone along with these craft cocktails that have been happening for the last number of years. I thought it was going to be probably limited to the United States. You know, I travel around the country quite a bit, or did. And it turned into this global cocktail book. And then I ended up actually, you know, taking, in the beginning, it was a terrifying journey, really, of I strung together 11 cities and did them in about 60 days. So at the beginning of that, I had never undertaken a journey of quite that, certainly breadth. And it was also quite long, but it was an incredible experience because I was able to take this sort of snapshot of global cocktailing as it is happening now, or was happening as far as, 2019, early 2020.
And it is an expansive journey. There's the Eucalypto Swizzle from Colombia, the Sydney Sour from Australia, among many others, from New Orleans to Tangier. I think Sao Paulo is in there. It really is a wonderful, fun way to, I think when it comes to cocktails, people are always looking for something a little bit different. And, for anyone, whether you're having a party or, you know, just maybe sitting down by yourself or with your partner, It's a nice way to kind of just change and spice things up and maybe transport you to a little different place. I'm curious about one thing. You know, when you chose the recipes, you know, if you take a Sydney sour, for example, let's focus on that one. I'm sure Sydney of many cities has a lot of different cocktail options, but how did you choose the Sydney sour? And I'm also curious how you chose any specific recipes. I think that oftentimes an interpretation of a recipe is sometimes up to the bartender, right? You ask for something and they make it their way or the way they learned or whatnot. I'm not trying to suggest you created the definitive guide, like this is the only way to make a Sydney sour. But if you can assume that Sydney sours are made at different bars, they're probably popular around Sydney. There may be some elements that are kind of localized about it. But how did you decide, you know what, this is what is going to be representative of each one of these drinks?
Yeah, that's a really great question. Tough decisions for one. I mean, in particular, Sydney, there can be a good argument can be made that actually the cocktail city in Australia is Melbourne, which has a lot of amazing cocktail spots. And that happened a few times in the book. Often I went with the capital. Sometimes it was just kind of a toss up in a way of which city was going to jump out in a particular region. Each city really was its own sort of microcosm and world. I started out with a massive spreadsheet. The book started out with, there's been a couple other historical books, which, you know, have matched the cocktails that we know, like Singapore Sling with Singapore kind of thing. They've been very historical. And I wanted this one to have a little bit of that, but also really capture what's happening now because so much has changed. And a book of classics kind of going around the world isn't as exciting as what's happening now. It was also a big issue of what cocktails can I put in there that people can do it, make at home? What is repeatable out of what is going on in some of these scenes? So Sydney, I was kind of, you know, that particular one, going with playing off a citrus season there, a few menus would have that citrus. I mean, it was just a tiny little bit. It was really tough with this book. You know, I basically got two cocktails per city, which, you know, is kind of a ridiculously small snapshot of what's going on in some of these major cocktail spots. But again, so it was winnowing down which cities I thought were interesting, talking to people on the ground, you know, funneling up information for the book, basically.
Let's talk a little bit about what's going on. And I want to admit, I think it's a boat that I personally missed, and I'll give a few examples of it. You know, we're here in San Diego and it's really anywhere. There's, you know, cocktail bars that really specialize in these intricately crafted drinks. I don't remember that 20 years ago, giving away my age. It's something new. I think, you know, cocktails, mixed drinks have always been around, of course, whether it's the old fashioned my dad drank or, you know, you're just more straightforward drinks. They've always been around, but there seems to be a refined appreciation for cocktails that it also seems to me a little bit generationally driven. I'll give an example. As I said, I've kind of given away my age a little bit about when I might have started going near bars. I have a neighbor that moved in. They're about 10 years younger than us. And they love making and mixing cocktails and are so passionate about it. And we'll talk about the different, you know, kinds of agave and mezcal that they're using and all these different things. And he'll talk about how he finally found a certain liquor down at a store and he drove an hour to get there, but he finally found it. And I'll tell you, he's a great neighbor to have. He's wonderful. He's nice. You know, showing up on the doorstep on a Tuesday at 6 o'clock saying, "You've got to try this." And I do, but I'm like, boy, you know, this is pretty stiff here for a Tuesday night. But I love the passion that he and his wife bring to it. All his friends bring that same passion. And I'm going to be honest, a lot of my friends don't have that. It seems that there's it's driven by a number of things, but one seems to be, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Andre, but folks that are, call it right now, in their 30s are very, very into and passionate about all the intricacies and using this drink and that drink. And I just, I feel to some extent prior to this present moment, it was like you had maybe 10 drinks that we all drank. You had top shelf and you had bottom shelf, and that was it. So am I characterizing the current moment right by using those anecdotes? And what or when was this shift that, like I said, I feel like I missed it. I went from college to now and just missed this whole, you know, craft cocktails and going to these bars, if you will, that just have these highly specialized approaches. And I will say, I appreciate it when I do have these drinks. But there's a fondness to it that I think is new. Am I correct in that?
I think you're right. I think there's a certain bonding with it. And a couple of things just to start out. I think in the United States, the boom really began around 2000. This sort of cocktail world that we live in now was sort of fomented in London by a man named Dick Bradsell, who's sadly passed on. He's famous for creating the Brambles, among a number of other famous cocktails that have sort of gone global since. And I'm at the same generation as you, basically. I stepped out into college and we were still in sort of what's considered now the bad old vodka soda days. And I think that, you know, people forget that, you know, when we were coming out of college, when you went to a bar, there was no menu. There were no cocktails on a chalkboard. You had to know what you wanted to drink, and that was by what your parents drank. Maybe you had an uncle that drank, so you knew about, you know, sidecars or something like that. And that was basically the extent of it. Maybe a French restaurant would have some French cocktails, and a cigar bar might have some Hemingway cocktails. But other than that, cocktails really, you know, we're still sort of stuck in this miasma of, you know, no one had fresh fruit. So you were getting, if you ordered anything with fruit, it was going to be a juice out of a jar or a can even, you know, that somebody had popped in the back. Soda was on a gun. We just didn't live in this world. And it's really interesting. It sort of started, I time it with a few big bars sort of in the early 2000s, started in New York. The Violet Hour, which is a famous cocktail bar, opened in Chicago in, I think, around 2006. And Varnish opened around 2009, let's call it 10. So New York in the beginning of the 2000s, Chicago was hit in the middle, and then sort of LA a little bit later to the game, although it caught up extraordinarily quickly, sort of around 2010. And I started writing my first cocktail book, The New Cocktail Hour, I want to say in something like 2014, which is a generation almost ago now, even though it's not, doesn't seem like that long in years, but it really was a long time ago. And what was interesting is at that time, I told the editors, gee, I think this cocktail thing may have run its course. You know, I had a cocktail column and I just didn't see it getting bigger. And what happened was, instead of sort of continuing, it just went nuclear, where every single restaurant had to have a cocktail menu. And it just went bonkers. And I think the difference that you're picking up on with the 30-year-olds versus the older folks is the 30-year-olds stepped out and into this boom. And it was a food boom. It was a small plates boom. It was a global cuisine boom. It kind of everything in food and beverage was kind of happening at the same time. Social media was already going. So everyone was taking pictures of these cocktails and their food and going out with their friends. And it just became really a part of, you know, daily life, I think. And I see that as well with, you know, folks that are younger. I also have neighbors that are sort of like in this cocktail club, which I only stick a toe into because it's what I do for a living and I need a break. It's funny how they're passing around all the, you know, all these, you know, recipes and ideas and stuff. And I do think it's really, you know, fantastic, because I think we grew up on, you know, say screwdrivers, or if we were lucky enough to have somebody in the family who made even just a really well-made martini was sort of unique back in the day. And I think for us, you know, cocktails probably came on the horizon with the Cosmopolitan, right, from Sex and the City. And then later grew even more with Mad Men. But those were kind of the big two cocktails on the screen for our generation. So I think you're right that this is kind of you know, something that's for young people. Although it's interesting, when I was able to go around the country and do classes or book signings or that kind of thing, a lot of people would, a lot of older folks come up to me and tell me, you know, their fond memories of some of these classic cocktails, which is amazing. Although a lot of people in the older generation want to pick up the book so they can appear hip to a hip child or a hip niece or nephew.
That I appreciate what you just walked us through there. That was really illustrative of where it came from. I was following along that journey, and you're right. It was like gin and tonics, rum and cokes. I mean, and I think the two tipping points there were actually having a menu, because
right.
You know, there was almost a, you didn't want to feel embarrassed ordering something that you would stick with maybe a screwdriver because everyone knew it, but you didn't want to order something and then the bartender says, "What's in that?"
Right.
Oh boy, yeah, I'm about to look like the fool, right?
You know, when I was younger, I ordered scotch because I thought that's what one did, because that's what people ordered in movies, basically. And we had one cocktail book at home, which wasn't very good. And I remember a rusty nail on it. And I remember my parents having Drambuie. So one of the first times I went into a cocktail bar, I ordered a rusty nail. And the bartender gives me this look of like, really? That's not particularly, not a particularly good drink. And certainly not for somebody who's 21, you know. I think you have to have at least some gray in your beard to order
a rusty father-in-law's preferred drink.
Exactly. Exactly. But these were the drinks we knew, you know, the Harvey Wallbangers and some of, you know, in my generation and I guess yours, you know, cocktails had kind of petered out to what I call the cranberry connection, you know, where all these like bay breezes and sea breezes, they could kind of retreated into, you know, country clubs or to wedding menus.
I think we found your next book, The History of. It is interesting to walk with you on that journey. And the other you mentioned is social media, right? Now, social media is all about trying to expose your glamorous lifestyle. So what better than a not only a great tasting, but a beautiful looking drink to be able to post right. to your friends that you are, you know, on this balcony having this drink that is certainly not just the straightforward gin and tonic. So it's there, but hey, it's all positive because I think it's certainly not that we're going out to too many restaurants these days, unfortunately, but it is wonderful to see what can be created out there and some of the surprises of the different tastes and textures that can, when in a well-blended cocktail can come about. I wanted to ask about another trend that's going on out there, which is, and I think they're related, but there's kind of an infusion of Mexican alcohol. You know, we've gone from one kind of tequila out there, right? It was Jose Cuervo to, I think it's fair to say hundreds at this point. You know, mezcal is very popular as well. So you have that trend. Then you have the other trend of celebrity-backed liquor, let's call it that. Right?
Sometimes those trends collide.
And those trends sometimes collide. We're not going to name any names here about any of them, but I think people generally know what we're talking about. Could you talk about those trends, the collision of them? And I think what might be interesting also for listeners is, how can I detect a quality liquor? There's certainly no shortage of celebrities out there willing to put their name in a $90 price tag on a bottle of liquor. And you know, some people must be buying it because I know that they're selling the companies. But how do we navigate that? And if you could talk about the merging of those two trends.
Yeah, so it's been interesting, the rise of Mexican distillates, as they're called, that you were talking about, sort of the rise of certainly mezcal, I guess, which is it's not quite tequila. Tequila all has to be made from blue Weber agave. It's the cactus is steamed, so you lose a lot of flavor there. And mezcal is done with a variety of different Actually, sorry, I shouldn't say cactus because it is not a cactus. As calling tequila people will get all over me. From a variety of different plants, and they can be family farmed. They're smoked or buried in a pit, and then distilled from that. So you end up with an artisanal product with a lot of flavor. And I think what intersected was the market was headed towards sort of artisanal products anyway. And then here comes this whole region that's right on our doorstep, which is, Oaxaca and tequila and down to Mexico. Ticked all the right boxes, and it just exploded. And I think also at the same time, we were headed towards spice and going back to what it was like to drink when we first came out of college versus what it is now. When I first came out of college, no one drank Negronis. Americans did not drink anything bitter. Maybe, some grandparents drank something bitter as medicine, or about as bitter as things got was probably Jägermeister. And, the rise of Campari is a big story, but I think tequila's caught up in that we just went for more and more flavor. If you think of vodka as being this flavorless alcohol that really, reigned supreme throughout the 80s and 90s, it was finally dethroned by with products that just had more flavor. And I think that's so you have the intersection of artisanal and more flavor, and also the intersection of, cocktail geekery is all about the history and the story and doing something that somebody else doesn't have. And there's a real fetishization going on, which, you were talking a little bit about with social media. So it all kind of came together until, sort of this mezcal boom. At the same time, the market is sort of this strange bifurcation where you have some people going for really artisanal small products, the same way that they would go for artisanal cheese or meat that's grown by a farmer that they know. And then the market also is going to these mega brands where you have vodka spritz, right? You've got all these hard seltzers and celebrities. And that's sort of these two cultures that are sort of vying with each other and playing off each other in really weird ways. There's not a lot of good celebrity stuff out there. A good celebrity liquor off the top of my head, strangely, is Metallica's Black Whiskey, because they went and they hired one of the best whiskey distillers in the world, Dave Pickerel, who sadly has passed recently. And they did some crazy stuff where they say that they play bass at the bass music, metal music really loud at the barrels. But the fact is that the stuff is really, really extraordinarily well made. They're at one end of the spectrum. Everybody else is sort of the middle bottom. And it's basically because the math doesn't add up. Certainly in mezcal, the agave is very difficult to grow. It has extraordinarily long maturation, some 6 years sometimes for some of them. The large companies have bought up all of the land and the agave plants. So if you find something with a celebrity name, that's basically they're just co-packing with some large product that wanted to put their name on it. So nobody's really digging into their liquor the way that like Metallica hired the best guy and dug into whiskey. If you can find that, great. The best way to find good stuff in a market that there's a lot of bad stuff in the market: one, go to a good liquor store. Two, ask people. I feel like even at sort of not great or middle of the road liquor stores, the clerks always know what's good. also, I won't always say that a big loud bottle is bad, but usually a big loud bottle is bad. If there's gold flakes in it or on it or anywhere near it, or it's sparkling or it has some sort of juice flavor, maybe stay away.
That's good advice though. It's like anything else. It's hard to know and determine. And we know that there's marketing trickery going on, and
it's gotten,
you're staring at these bottles and you're like, I haven't bought tequila in a year. Do I go with this? Do I go with that? It's very hard. It almost seems almost more consequential sometimes than choosing wine is.
Right.
When doing that. I love Metallica. They seem built to have a brand. I mean, you look
right.
What are their song names? Right, Nothing Else Matters, and
right,
you know, Ride the Lightning and Fade to Black. I mean, they seem built for it. But hey, it's fair, I think, to give them a plug if they're doing things the right way. And it sounds like a whiskey that is worth checking out. Another trend that's out there is the zero proof movement.
Yep.
So this is, you know, actual. Well, I'll let you describe it, but it's non-alcoholic, like gins and, you know, and whiskeys that I haven't had them, but I believe taste quite similar, so that you can, you know, enjoy the experience of a cocktail, the taste of on a Tuesday night when my neighbor is mixing up something with five shots in it. I can enjoy something that, you know, perhaps for health reasons, perhaps, you know, it's just, for whatever reason, you know, you don't want to actually have alcohol. It's very different than the O'Doul's, you know, era of just non-alcoholic beer. But go ahead and kind of talk about the advent and I think growth of the zero proof movement.
Yeah, it's, you know, back in the, let's call them the bad old days, you'd walk into a bar or restaurant and there really wouldn't be any non-alcoholic options on the menu. And it became very clear that things were changing, whether the people had, you know, gone to Alcoholics Anonymous or whether they were pregnant or whether you are not wanting to drink for whatever reason, or, you know, you're a designated driver, that things needed to change. Now, some of the best cocktail bars realized very early on that you could use your leftover juices or spent, you know, kind of side products on stuff to create really excellent drinks that actually were cost effective for the bar to use up. You know, you can basically charge the same amount of money for non-alcoholic drink as you can an alcoholic drink. I think they're important, extraordinarily important at bars to have on the menu so that people can order a non-alcoholic drink. You know, it's not good enough to just say, oh, well, you can make that drink non-alcoholic. There should be special choices for non-drinkers so they don't feel left out, because so much of it is social. So much of it is the pageantry of having a bartender make a drink for you. So there's that aspect. One of the interesting things was, to me, I've always been a little suspicious of the non-alcoholic movement when it does two things. One, it goes so far as to start feeling like a sort of neo-prohibition movement, and there's a shaming of drinkers. So first we were shaming non-drinkers, now we're shaming drinkers. And, you know, so any of that back and forth is sort of, you know, I don't think it's helpful. The other thing is that it's always been a little strange to me that, you know, these brands that are coming out with the non-alcoholic stuff, I mean, you're paying the same amount of money for a bottle of who knows what is in it actually, as you would an alcoholic product. And so, and that's fine. If some of them are good and they can mimic body, they can mimic, you know, mouthfeel, they can mimic some stuff. Great. If you want to spend your money on that. I do think that there's an aspect to it of, it was the same when vegetarian foods first, you know, kind of mainstreamed the United States, everything had to be a hamburger or a chicken nugget, you know? And so it's like, it'd be nice to free ourselves of what a non-alcoholic cocktail has to look like or has to taste like, you know, because I feel like right now we're still in the sort of, let's make a non-alcoholic cocktail, but make sure it tastes like X, you know, make sure it tastes like a martini. The same way that early vegetarians were, or at least the market was like, let's make a vegetarian burger. Well, just free yourself from the burger. The whole world, most of the world eats vegetarian for food that doesn't look anything like a chicken nugget or a burger. So there's some of that. I think we're sort of in the beginning phases of, you know, figuring it out. Some of these products will last, some won't. It's been interesting, again, about bifurcations in the market. I think the US market just has so many crazy extremes in it. People probably haven't been drinking this much liquor at home in a very, very long time. Liquor sales are through the roof. And at the same time, the statistics on the non-alcoholic stuff is through the roof, like 130% year-over-year growth in the market. So kind of both are happening. You know, I think this has been an extraordinarily tough time for a lot of people. A lot of people maybe hit the bottle too much in the beginning of this and sort of are bouncing back. So I just think we're... we're in an interesting spot. I mean, for me, the more product to play with, the more fun, really.
Exactly. And that's what it should be. And we hope that those increases are people having fun, experimenting, and not, you know, other methods of dealing with, with this current time. We have a few minutes left. You ready for some rapid fire questions?
Yeah.
All right. What's your favorite or best cocktail you've ever had?
Oh, my favorite best cocktail I've ever had. I'm a Manhattan guy, a well-made Manhattan. I still remember some of the first Manhattans I got. People forget that we used to not have good Amarana cherries. We had cherries that were maraschino, and they were had red dye. We used to not be able to get rye whiskey. So if a Manhattan came with good vermouth that was fresh, an Amarana cherry and a rye whiskey, that was exciting. And it's still exciting to me now that we can have that.
Didn't expect Manhattan. I thought you were going to throw me something from Vienna or from Cape Town or something like that.
So many showstoppers in Singapore and Singapore or Kiev was a real eye opener. You know, there's crazy cocktails being made in Tokyo and whatnot, but I'm kind of a classics guy and I do like the just basic pageantry of a really fantastic bartender making a very simple drink. It's like Bach, you know, there's nowhere to hide. It's still beautiful.
You segued into my next question. Okay.
All right.
You got 2 days. It's maybe you and your partner, your missus, and I'm going to pay for your flight and your hotel. But this is a cocktail trip. You're going to one city and you can only have cocktails the entire time. What city are you going to? It's one city. I want one answer.
I'd have to say Hong Kong. And the reason is it's a very small, it's a small, committed, it's actually physically, all the bars are located near each other. I'm worried about Hong Kong for so many reasons, the takeover by China, but also just the economy over there. What a fantastic drinking city. And I'm worried that it's one that, won't come out of this the same way that, that it was in 2019.
All right. So you've got a couple of couples, a couple of friends coming over and they expect a heck of a cocktail, but they expect fun also. What is it that you're whipping up at home for them?
Well, this time of year in Philadelphia, it's still 90 some degrees. So there's no shame in a pina colada. It's many people's dirty little secret, and especially bartenders. I'll talk to these craft cocktail bartenders, men and women, and they will all kind of admit to, you have a real weakness for pina coladas. You know, something about the coconut, the mouthfeel, they get you where you need to go pretty quickly, all of the above. That's certainly a top contender.
I would accept one. All right, next one, ready? Your boss has his or her 50th birthday coming up. $100 seems to be what you're willing to spend on someone that can fire you. What do you buy him or her? And maybe him and her is a different answer.
I probably him and her would be the same answer. I would probably do whiskey, and I would probably do in the $100 range. I mean, whiskeys change every day, so it's confusing about what brands are what, but I'm, pretty bullish, as I think everybody in the industry is, on products from Buffalo Trace. So Buffalo Trace, I would probably go with Eagle Rare, which is just a fine American bourbon that probably comes in most of the time, should come in at $100.
All right, so Eagle Rare gets you another year of employment.
Yes.
Last question. What's your favorite place to have a cocktail? I want a domestic answer and a global answer. What is the bar, the balcony, or the atmosphere, the ambiance that What are those two magical places, one domestically and one globally?
You want a specific bar or just
the X rooftop on this place? What really stands out?
Really hard to say. There's so many. I really do love kind of the outdoor features of Los Angeles, but I am a classics guy, and it's hard to beat a bar like Maison Premier, which is in New York, which is sort of, everything you think about as a craft cocktail bar, bartenders with stiff white shirts and probably suspenders and probably bow ties. I do love a bar like that. Otherwise, it would be a bar, a hole in the wall somewhere in Asia, either Singapore or Tokyo, and that would be kind of fulfilling the weird, maybe smoky, but probably not smoky dent, like a sort of cocktail dent.
I'm transported there now. All right, yes. One last question. Is there a bad place to have a cocktail? Not really, huh?
There really isn't. I would say nightclubs are not great. You're going to get a plastic cup and you're going to get a lot of sugar.
Bottom shelf, bunch of in an $18 bill for a right. Bottom shelf cup exactly. Of sugar.
Exactly.
Well, Andre, this has been fun. A reminder, you've got your book out there. It's Booze Cruise, A Tour of the World's Essential Mixed Drinks. It's at andredollington.com. I think my old Boston accent came through there. So just go nice. To Amazon, put yes. in Booze Cruise, A Tour of the World's Essential Mixed Drinks to be able to, you know, you can find all of the books and work there as well. You're a lot of fun. I look forward to an invite one day when I'm around Philly to one of your cocktail parties, maybe.
Yes, I'll look you up when I'm in San Diego. You have Raised by Wolves out there, I think, that I have not been to. Pretty famous American cocktail bar. Thank you for having me on. This is fantastic.
I'll match you up with my neighbor. And
Yes, exactly. We can see what these kids are up to these days.
Yeah, it is wonderful to watch. I mean, but just the care and passion he has for it is just, it's just unique. My friends and I, we just did not grow up around that. And clearly he and his friends and his wife did. And you know, it's cool anytime anyone's passionate about something. So
yeah, exactly.
Thank you very much for joining us. Best of luck with your book, and we'll keep an eye out for the next one. I can't imagine what it's going to be. You've gotten Batman in there. You've got the world tour, you know, drinks and recipes inspired by films we love. That's a really cool one. That's probably a great gift to give, you know, movie fans as well.
Yeah, I can drop a little bit of info that the next book is going to be a Booze and Vinyl 2, which I never thought that I would see. I'm super excited that the first one did well enough to give us a follow-up volume. And that will be out in spring of next year, spring of 22.
Awesome. Well, thanks for letting us know. You have an exclusive here.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks again for joining us. Thanks for listening to Beyond the Shelf, presented by Chef's Best. If you enjoyed today's episode, please don't forget to rate us and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your episodes. For more details about all of our episodes from inside the ever-changing food and beverage industry, visit chefsbest.com.